Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Dude's perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. And I was almost a dry dude while we were in Salt Lake City.
Oh, yeah?
That was the other place we went other than San Jose, the home of the Winchester Mystery House. We went to Salt Lake City, Utah. And, you know, we've talked before about the strange drinking laws they have there, the laws controlling alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, they have, the Zion?
The Zion Curtain.
Zion Curtain.
We encountered that.
Did you really?
Well, we went in two different restaurants that had bars, but you didn't see a bar anywhere.
Really?
Nope. It was back behind the scenes. You did not see a bartender. You didn't see bottles. You didn't see anything. And, I mean, that was unusual. But in the whole, I guess the whole state, I don't guess it's just the city, you can't get anything stronger than 4% beer.
Oh, wow.
So there's a very limited amount of beers at the at your convenience stores or whatever, because not that many people are going to downgrade their beers to be able to sell it in Utah.
Now, you can possess them, I guess, from different states, right? As long as you didn't buy them there.
They just don't sell them there. The stores can't sell anything stronger than 4% beer. So, you know, I can't drink that much beer to get to where I need to be on 4% beer.
I think you'd be hard pressed to find a 4% beer.
I know. That's what I mean. So there were some local ones that they had there that were made specifically for that, but a lot of the big ones that you normally would see, they're just not there.
I mean, I think like Budweiser's 4.2 or something, isn't it?
I couldn't tell you. I hadn't drank Budweiser in 10 years or more.
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, but like most of your domestic beers, I think are at least like 4.2.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, then the really stingy thing, we go in, I mean, this was a Dave and Buster's. Going to Dave and Buster's, and you go to order a drink, they card you no matter who you are. I got carded. I'm an old dude, and I got carded. And it's not just they glance at it. They write something down on the ticket. I don't know whether it was your driver's license number or what, but they wrote something down off of the driver's license. That's how specific it was. Mm-hmm. They had to have this on file for everybody that came in there and ordered a drink. Then, at one point, somebody ordered a drink. And what they brought them was the wrong drink. They ordered something at first, then changed their mind. And she brought out the first one that they had changed their mind about and put it down. They said, well, just leave it there and I'll take the next one. Lady waitress goes, no, I can't do that. It's like, why not? Said, no one is allowed to be at the table with more than one drink in front of them.
Wow.
You can't have two drinks sitting in front of you. Like if somebody were to give you one, you couldn't have it there. And so she said, it needs to sit in front of him and hand it over to me because I had ordered beer. And I said, well, I've got a drink. She said, yeah, but that's beer. You can have one other drink sitting with your beer. But you can't have two alcoholic beverages sitting in front of you.
So that was my question. If it's quarter draft, can you not order $5 worth?
I think you could order a couple of beers at a time.
Okay.
So that would be all right. But
that's how you did it on Fridays at quarter draft.
Yeah.
You just go with your $5 bill and say, give me $5 worth.
But it was just unbelievable that it was that hard to get a drink there. And here's the other thing. They're only allowed 1 ounce pours on any of their mixed drinks. And it's a firm 1 ounce. There's a measuring thing on every bottle that they use. So they only can pour 1 ounce. Well, most of the drinks, you're just drinking sugar. There wasn't enough liquor in there to even taste it.
You can't order a double?
No.
No doubles?
Nope. One ounce.
No triples?
Nope. 1 ounce. Think about a shot. If you ordered a shot, it'd be like, is there anything in here? I mean, it was unbelievable. It was very frustrating to sit in there. It was like, well, that ruined the whole buzz for everything, you know?
Well, I have an idea about how you could have got better service.
How's that?
You could have bribed somebody.
Well, bribing seems to be a very common practice these days.
It does.
Especially if you're a celebrity, huh?
That's right. And you need to get your kid into school.
Yeah. The heck with the old-fashioned way of studying and earning your way. Let's just pay somebody.
That's not the old-fashioned. The old-fashioned way is your parents build a new library on campus.
Well, that's true.
That's the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. Now they just pay it and Photoshop your face onto an athlete's body.
So what we're talking about is the college admission scandal that's been in the news. I guess it's probably the past month, but there were some more things that came out this past week with regards to new charges and new things like that.
Yes, it just keeps growing. We love to see celebrities fall, don't we?
Fall from grace.
The general public, it's like when it has to do with celebrities and they get in trouble. Even if you like that celebrity, it seems like people root for them to get in trouble.
Ooh, big tree fall hard.
Yeah. Ooh, look at that person. They had a lot of money and now look where they're at.
So basically, if you haven't been paying attention to what's in the news, this was a bribery scandal where basically these different celebrities had conspired to influence different admission decisions with regards to their kids at a bunch of different universities. And it first came to light on March 12th that the U.S. federal prosecutors said that at least 50 people were alleged to have been a part of it. And a number of them have gone ahead and pled guilty to it, but some of them have not. And basically the way it all worked was that what these people were doing was that they were paying this man named William Singer, and he was the kind of the ringleader of this whole deal, and they were paying him to try to influence these different college admission boards and help their kids get into the schools they wanted to go to.
Yeah, he was the brains behind this, the architect, if you will.
They would do different things. Like, he would say that basically for $4,000 or $5,000, he can get a different report saying that your child has some sort of learning disability, which would get them more time on tests, even though they actually don't have a learning disability. He would do things like try to influence where they would take the SAT because he had different people on the inside at certain testing facilities where they would actually help the child with the SAT, or sometimes even change the child's answers after they had turned it in.
Sometimes the child wasn't even present.
Yeah.
And somebody took the test for them.
Or pay somebody else to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's actually somebody else.
And he owned these facilities that were approved to have SAT tests or whatever taken at under certain circumstances. So he had control over them completely.
Yeah. So basically this guy was the kind of the one who you needed to talk to if you needed to get your kid into school somewhere and they couldn't do it on their own merit.
Well, the five schools that seemed to be involved were UCLA, USC, Stanford, Yale, and Georgetown.
Yeah, it was mainly kind of a
West Coast thing, mostly.
One that I saw that was also included was Wake Forest and also University of Texas.
Yeah.
There's some other ones involved, too. So,
but I think that he started out having a legitimate a business that was helping improve people's scores and helping streamline the operation of applying for some of these colleges and everything. And somewhere along the line, he figured out, hey, you know what? There's some money to be made here. If I do this right, there's certain people, you know, he had conversations, he had close contact with administrators and coaches and things like that. And I think somewhere along the line, he said, I think I've got an idea.
The old gears started turning up there.
Yeah.
Now he had two different firms, Key Worldwide Foundation, which that's a great name for a company, I'm not going to lie. And then the Edge College and Career Network, which was also known as the Key. So those were his two different nonprofit companies that he ran. Although I think he made a profit.
Oh, he made a big profit.
Right.
But not as far as the government knew.
Yeah. As far as the company did, they did not.
Yeah.
Now, the way this all came down is that the FBI started investigating this, and they actually nicknamed the investigation Operation Varsity Blues, which that movie is actually 20 years old now this year, which is crazy.
Yeah. And here's what got me. I started thinking about it. I thought, Varsity Blues, was there some ringer that they brought in somehow with money? Then that's what happened. So I had to go back and look at the plot. It had nothing to do with anything like that. I don't understand. You had the late Paul Walker was a quarterback for the team, and
Paul
he
Walker
got
wasn't
injured.
The quarterback?
Yeah, he got injured.
Oh yeah, you're right. I was thinking of.
He had a gruesome injury and was out, and that promoted James Vanderbeek, the second string guy, who really had no interest, was just there because his dad wanted him to play football.
Right, he was kind of a book nerd type.
Very
guy.
Irreverent, and you had John Voight, the crusty old coach, going for his 23rd title, and of course John Voight, he's Angelina Jolie's father as well as the Midnight Cowboy, if you remember that far back.
Playing football at West Canaan may have been the opportunity of your lifetime, but I don't want your life.
But
that's my Mox impersonation.
You know, the thing was him him stepping into this and accepting the role in it, but it had nothing to do with any kind of money laundering or cheating or bribery. I don't understand why they gave it that name. The FBI isn't very bright naming these things.
I think it fits.
Why?
Well, because a lot of, well, part of the scandal too, which we didn't talk about yet, we're going to get into though, is they actually had kind of like fake athletic scholarships for these people, or basically that That's they were true. Some sort of athletic thing.
Yeah, and the so athletic coaches were involved in it.
They were. Actually, quite a few at different schools.
Yeah.
So basically, that's a varsity sport, correct?
Right.
And it makes you sad. It makes you blue that they did this.
Oh, well, I guess if you put it together that way, okay, fine. That's a reach, though.
I don't think so.
Varsity blues. How about varsity bribes?
Yeah, that works. That works, too. It's actually kind of sad if you think about it.
It is sad. And most of the kids evidently didn't know it.
Well, now, I think the ones that thought they were going there because they had never even like rowed on a crew team before and thought they were going there to row crew, I think they probably knew what was up.
Well, there was one kid, I remember saying, I don't remember whose kid it was, but they said that one of the requirements at the school is you actually had to, if you were on scholarship, you had to be on the field dressed for the games. So they gave her a uniform. And I think it was girls soccer. Mm-hmm. And I think that she had to be on the field in a uniform. Of course, she never played and she never practiced. So she had to know something was up. Why do I have to be there for all the games?
Well, you know, and I got to think, like, I mean, I played soccer in college. Mm-hmm. Everybody on the team was pretty daggone good. I mean, you don't play usually a collegiate sport unless you have some skill at it.
Right.
I can't imagine being on the team and having somebody just show up wearing a uniform, and they're just, I've never seen it practice.
And the other was looking, what's up with her?
They don't know how to kick a ball. Like, you know, I mean, I think probably that might lead to a lot of anger from the team. Because,
well, right.
Because in order to play in college as a college athlete, you have to work really hard and hone your skills to get good at it and get better at it. And I think, I mean, I would be very indignant of anybody else who basically was a phony on the field like that.
And there are only a number of scholarships available, so it's not like it's just indefinite. So if she takes one, that's somebody else that didn't get one.
Yeah, absolutely.
That may have been deserving, you know. Absolutely. That might have been their dream to go there and play soccer, and they didn't get it because of her.
Yeah, so I think it's horrible, and I think it's, I mean, I don't know how this all came to light, but if that was the case and it came to light, these athletes found out about it, I have no doubt that they would have spilled the beans on it. They were probably pretty mad about it.
Yeah, when it came to light, the only thing they knew about for sure was that William Singer was behind it, because he was the first one contacted. He was the one the FBI investigated, and he was the one they contacted. And that's kind of looks like what's going to be the irony of this. By him describing his entire operation to the FBI, it looks like they're going to let him go while he named names.
Well, I think he's facing 40-some years in prison.
Yeah, he's facing a lot of charges, but he's cooperating.
Well,
he was the first cooperating witness, so they're probably going to go easy on him.
But somebody before this had to spill the beans on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why they initially started investigating him. But somebody had to have said something.
And I bet it was one of these athletes on one of these teams. They're probably like, uh-uh. No, this isn't going to fly.
Yeah. Yeah, I would be quick to say something.
Yeah. So this past Monday, the prosecutors announced that 13 of the parents, who was actually including the actress Felicity Huffman, they were going to plead guilty.
Right. With no guarantee of no jail time.
Right. They were just pleading guilty, leaving the sentencing was up to the court, essentially. But the other parents decided not to plead guilty, and they were actually indicted on new charges. So what they're pleading guilty to, these 13, is they're going to plead guilty to a single count of conspiracy to commit mail fraud and honest service mail fraud.
So what is mail fraud?
Well, mail fraud and honest mail service fraud, there's two different actual things. And well, the first charge is the conspiracy. So conspiracy is basically when you conspire with someone else, or you make a deal or a plan with somebody else to commit some sort of crime and take one step furtherance in commission of that crime. So that's how you get to the conspiracy. So whether or not you actually completed the crime or not, if you took one step in furtherance of it after agreeing to do it with somebody else, that's actually a conspiracy charge right there. So you don't actually have to go through with it. So that's the first count, is the conspiracy to commit mail fraud. And then honest service mail fraud is kind of different than your regular mail fraud. And I had actually never heard of the term before, so I had to kind of look it up to figure out what it was. And so the courts had basically prior to 1987, interpreted mail fraud and wire fraud statutes as criminalizing not only schemes to defraud victims of money and property, but also schemes to defraud victims of intangible rights, such as the honest services of a public official.
Oh.
So when they're talking about honest service, they're talking about the honest services of some sort of public official. Now,
or I guess collegiate people are considered public officials?
Well, they are, but I'm going to get into that a bit more and kind of go into it, because this kind of this law actually grows a little bit and is interpreted by the courts a little bit more.
Okay.
So in 1987, the Supreme Court of the U.S. ruled in McNally v. United States that mail fraud and wire fraud statutes pertain strictly to schemes to defraud victims of tangible property, including money. So basically they said, no, we don't think that this honest service is actually falls under the guise of what mail fraud is. So in reaction to that, in 1988, Congress enacted a new law that specifically criminalized schemes to defraud victims of the intangible right of honest services. So this was a new law in 1988, which is basically a different kind of branch off of the wire of the mail fraud.
Okay.
So honest service fraud is generally more easily proven in the public sphere than in private, because honest service frauds by public officials can include most any unethical conduct that some sort of public official might do. Whereas honest services fraud by private individuals only includes some unethical conduct. And federal courts have generally recognized two main areas where public sector honest mail fraud exists, which one is being bribery, which can either be direct or indirect. So in this case, it would have been kind of indirect on the part of the parents, but direct on the part of, what's his name?
William Singer.
William Singer.
Yeah.
So William Singer's singing like a bird now, I guess. So.
Well, and they knew what they were involved in. I mean, they knew they were giving money to a fake charity and that they were writing it off, and it was basically illegal because the money was going to bribe somebody to get their kid into school.
Yeah.
So, or to fix their test.
And so basically, the bribery is where a public official was paid in some way for a particular decision or an action and a failure to disclose a conflict of interest resulting in personal gain for that person. So that's kind of what you're looking at. But it can also be used in private corruption as well. So if there's a private entity too, and there's a case from 2006, which was kind of interesting. I thought I would explain that a little bit. It was U.S. v. Williams, and the defendant was John Williams, and he was an Oregon insurance salesman who had sold several annuities to an elderly rancher named Lloyd Stubbs. Stubbs liquidated his annuities, and what Williams did is he deposited the resulting funds in a joint bank account he had opened in his and Stubbs' names together. And so he would take a lot of massive cash advances from it and deposit the money in his own personal accounts, and he spent a lot of it. He wired some of it to a personal bank accounts. One was in Belize, one was in Louisiana. And he was subsequently convicted of 4 counts of wire fraud, 3 counts of mail fraud, 3 counts of money laundering, and 1 count of foreign transportation of stolen money. And the fraud charges stem from the scheme to defraud Stubbs of the money and Williams' honest services as his financial advisor. So basically, he tried to argue that didn't apply to private commerce because this honest service mail fraud only applied to the public sector.
Uh-huh.
But the court disagreed and basically said that no, since there was this fiduciary relationship between him, that actually accounted as honest services as well, because the person was entitled to the honest services of this professional, and they breached that fiduciary duty by doing that.
Well, sure.
So it can be...
happens to professional athletes all the time.
It does.
People that manage their money, they're sitting there making hundreds of millions a year, and they retire and look around, and they're broke. It's like, where'd it go?
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of that can be chalked up to kind of bad decisions as well, too. You know, they invest in a lot of kind of, you know...
Well, sometimes.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, it could be. Or it went up their nose.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, this honest services mail frauds actually can be construed in a lot of different ways, and it's pretty broad.
What always throws me off is the term mail fraud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because to me, it means it has to do with something being sent through the mail.
Right.
And it doesn't really have to be sent through the mail. Like, none of this was necessarily sent through the mail.
Well, I think generally it used to be, but I think now it means more like kind of interstate commerce.
So does it come under the Commerce Clause?
I'm sure.
The famous Commerce Clause?
I'm sure it does, yeah. That gives the states the ability or the federal government the ability to regulate commerce between the states.
So is mail fraud then a federal crime when they charge you? It's not a state crime?
Well, it can be a state crime or a federal crime. As charged in the U.S. courts, it's definitely a federal crime. And especially this honest services mail fraud, it relates to directly to that 1988 Congress law, which defines it.
Well, if the FBI is investigating it, they're probably doing it in a federal manner, huh?
They are.
And it's before a district judge, so that's a federal judge, right?
It is, but actually, the statute, as written, grants jurisdiction to the federal government to prosecute local, state, and federal officials, too. So it's not just kind of a federal official type thing. It can be these local officials, too. And it's basically the main tool that is used to fight public corruption because it's easier to prove than bribery or extortion.
Main tool.
And the term honest services is really open to jury interpretation. It's very broad. And prosecutors often use it with like RICO, the Racketeer Influenced Corruptions Act. So they pair it with that, as well as, like I said, mail and wire fraud. And
throwing a little money laundering just for good measure.
Throwing money laundering. And they show that to prove like this whole conspiracy thing. And actually, the former Justice Antonin Scalia, he's since passed away, he criticized the statute, and he said that the clause was so poorly defined that it could be the basis for prosecuting a mayor for using the prestige of his office to get a table at a restaurant without a reservation.
Huh.
So he didn't really like it because he said it was too broad. And I will tell you, that is one thing that I tended to agree with Scalia about, is that he generally was a very strict constructionist when it came to things like that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he was a conservative, but he was conservative as an approach to everything. He wanted basically laws to be read conservatively. So mm-hmm. I agreed with him in that. Some of his decisions, not so much, but other things, I liked him. So
have you seen the movie Vice yet?
Vice?
The story of Dick Cheney?
No, I have not.
Scalia is depicted in that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is he depicted, his involvement. Is he depicted in a not so good light?
Let's just say that he was a Dick Cheney crony.
Yeah.
but it surprised me some of the things he was involved in. Not that it was anything illegal. It was just kind of very biased politics.
Yeah. Well, I think that whole thing with Cheney, and I mean, I haven't seen the movie, but my understanding is he was a pretty much a power player in Washington.
Yeah.
And knew where all the bodies were buried.
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. I don't know how accurate it is to what really happened. I mean, who knows what happens behind closed doors, because they certainly didn't participate in it, but it was a very interesting movie.
You know, looking at some of the different names that were included in this, Felicity Huffman, I was looking at her. I mean, I had heard her name before.
Sure. Desperate Housewives.
Well, I never watched that show.
Oh.
And so I was looking at different shows that she's been in and movies and things like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I've ever seen her in anything. I mean, evidently she was in an episode of The X-Files at one point, and I've seen all The X-Files, so maybe I saw her in that.
I've seen her in a bunch of things.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, she's recent things. Some of that American Crime or something like that, I think she was in.
Didn't watch it.
She's been in a lot of things, and of course she's married to William H. Macy.
Well, now that's the one thing I did know, is that she's married to William Macy. And the thing is that I thought was amazing about this is that it's their child, right?
Right.
He wasn't indicted. He wasn't charged or anything about that.
Well, here's what I understood the story was. She came to him with, hey, I can get this done to help out our child. And he said, don't do it. I wouldn't get involved in that.
Really?
And so she did it without his knowledge after that. Once he said, that's a bad idea, don't get involved.
So they actually had a conversation about it, and he said, I don't want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of makes me like him a little bit more.
Yeah, he said, that's not a good idea. Hey, you get a bunch of college-age kids, and if they know what's going on, you know, then they're going to talk. You know, they're not very smart sometimes.
Well, especially they've proven the fact they can't get into the college like that.
Yeah, and Lori Loughlin's, one of Lori Loughlin's daughters, another actress from, what was it,
Full House? Yeah.
Her daughter sits on there and has a YouTube. She's evidently a very popular YouTuber.
Yeah, she's an influencer.
Yeah, an influencer. And she sat there and would talk about how, you know, my interest in school, I'm not going to go to class. And here her mother just paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to bribe her way in there. And she's bragging about how she doesn't go to class and has no interest in getting a degree.
Lori Loughlin, I never really watched Full House either.
Oh, I watched that. And the reboot.
I didn't watch
Fuller House.
As far as I'm concerned, this seems...
Well, see, I live in a house full of women.
That's true.
So I don't have much choice with the TV there sometimes.
That's true. I'm surrounded by dudes.
Yeah. I'm surrounded by girls.
That's right. So, yeah, mainly what we watch at the house is sports.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, anime. But
Well, I don't want to watch anime, but if there's more sports, I might hang out at your house.
So. I don't watch anime so much.
It's not anime porn, is it?
No, it's not.
That's good.
At least I hope not. I don't watch it, so better not be. But yeah, it seemed like a lot of these famous people, I didn't really know who they were. Lori Loughlin evidently married Massimo Giannulli, who was the creator of the Massimo clothing line.
Yeah, he's some kind of fashion guy.
Which I'd heard of Massimo. I think he even had a pair of Massimo shorts at some point in my life.
Right.
So I'd heard of him, but I didn't really know any of these people.
Well, there was a few that they named that were CEOs of companies, Silicon Valley companies and some stuff like that. So I'd heard of the company.
Yeah.
But I'd never heard of the actual person. I'd just heard of the business they were associated with.
Now, as we said, now Felicity Huffman, I believe she's pleading guilty. And she's pleading to those the conspiracy and the honest services mail fraud.
And they've got their fingers crossed that they don't do any jail time, but there was no guarantee of that.
That's right. Now, the other 16 of the original 33 parents, which includes Lori Loughlin and some others, they pled not guilty to the original charges. And they were additionally charged with conspiracy to commit money laundering by the federal prosecutors in Boston in a superseding indictment. So basically what the prosecution did...
You didn't take our deal? Now we're going to give it to you.
Yeah, we're going to really drop the hammer. We're going to add to it.
Well, they evidently used that as motivation. Hey, look, either take this plea deal or we're going to bring up more charges. Then they must have said, go ahead.
Yeah.
Do your worst.
Well, and that's kind of a common ploy among prosecutors.
Sure.
They'll say... We are offering you this plea deal now, but if you don't take it, then all bets are off and we're going to go ahead and prosecute to the fullest extent by the law.
And apparently they weren't bluffing.
Well, and they really shouldn't either because, you know, if they gave them a fair plea deal, obviously, I mean, you're innocent until proven guilty, but I got to say, this looks like a pretty strong case if you ask me.
Yeah.
And in my humble opinion.
And the guy who all the money went through is singing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they're going to try to crack him or something like that. He's giving it up because he's wanting to be in as good as possible to reduce his own liability of this thing.
And I got to think, you're not going to find too many jurors who are going to be very compassionate towards these people.
Right.
I mean, these are all these wealthy people who basically use their wealth and prestige to give them a leg up on everyone else in the country.
Yeah, and not too many people will feel sorry for you for that. And they said, you know, there's a whole lot of that kind of goes on anyway. Like you say, build the library and stuff. But this was just blatant, you know, going about it this way with the bribes and everything.
From Full House to the Big House.
Yeah, that's right.
I think I've probably read that somewhere.
I think
There's no way I just came up with that.
When I saw that today about them adding those money laundering charges, I wanted to look and see, well, jail-wise or, you know, punishment-wise, what's the difference between the two? Because money laundering must be a much worse charge than mail fraud if the thing they're going to drop the hammer on is money laundering.
Yeah.
So I looked it up. It said for mail fraud crimes, the possible punishments is a felony that carries a sentence of up to 5 years in prison and or fines of up to $250,000. Well, they paid more than that to get their kid into college, so that's a drop in the bucket, you know.
They can pay that to stay out of jail.
Yeah. So when individuals are involved. It's up to 30 years in prison and or $1 million in fines when a financial institution is involved. So it's much worse. But these were individuals, so, you know, 5 years in prison and $250,000 in this day and age, they're not going to put up somebody in prison for 5 years for something like this.
Probably not.
They're probably going to get probation or home confinement or, you know, go out and pick up trash in the neighborhood or something, you know?
They may, but, you know, then again, they may make example of these people.
Well, they could. But then you look at money laundering, and it said, first of all, the government does not have to prove that the person actually handled the money or did anything specific to assist the money laundering offense. Money laundering is a serious crime under federal law. A violation of 18 U.S.C. 1956 can result in a sentence of up to 20 years in prison.
Ooh, that's a stiff penalty.
Yeah, even, you know, 5 years and they're not going to give you the whole 5 years. You're looking at maybe one or two. Mm-hmm. When it's 20 years and they're not going to give you the whole 20, you might be looking at 10.
Yeah.
So that does get a whole lot worse.
Absolutely. So this new indictment adding money laundering is really a hammer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. I think if I was given those choices, I think I'd have rolled the dice and hoped they went easy on me.
Yeah.
And gone ahead and taken the plea.
It'd be interesting to know if their attorneys advised them to take the plea or not. Because you can, as the attorney, you can only tell your client what you would recommend them to do. Mm-hmm. You can't actually tell them they have to do something. It's ultimately their decision. It has to be entered openly and freely. So, you know, you might sit there with somebody and be like, I really, really suggest you look at this plea awfully hard because here's the downside. You know, they might come back and hit you with this. And if they do, then you're facing this.
Yeah.
You know, I've actually had clients that have refused a plea deal that was a great plea deal. And I've actually had them, I've written out something that says, I've advised you to take this and you have refused to do it.
So they can't come back later.
And I make them sign it.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, that's how good of a plea deal this is, that you're an idiot, basically. So that's you're an idiot sign.
Well, my knowledge of money laundering comes from the Netflix show Ozarks.
Yeah.
That I've been watching that with Jason Bateman, and he's involved. That's what that's all about. So
it's a good show.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good show. But I was curious about the term money laundering. Where did that term originate from? And it said it was to have originated with the Italian mafia, with such criminals as Al Capone, who allegedly purchased laundromats to commingle or mix their illegal profits from prostitution and bootlegging liquor sales with legitimate business sales from the laundromats to obscure their illegal activities.
Huh.
So that's where the laundering money came from.
Now it's just kind of passed into popular culture as a way to wash money.
Right? Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
But this is that happening. Prohibition was what launched the first money laundering laws.
Right.
Because of that. So they had to pass laws. So that was back in the 30s. You know, everything takes a while, even though, you know, prohibition was before that. It was in the 30s. By the time they enacted the laws, it actually defined money laundering. Then another big event came along that increased the range of what money laundering covered. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't.
The 1980s and the war on drugs.
Yeah.
They increased the definition of it further. And then one more big thing happened that caused it to even go further, that basically pushed it to international laws.
The war on terror?
The September 11th attacks.
The Patriot Act?
The September 11th attacks started so that other countries joined in together, and the G7 mm-hmm. joined in together to fight against money laundering, and they would work together to do that. So that was three big events in our history that actually pushed the money laundering laws along.
Now, I was reading, there's actually some more possible fallout from what took place.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things was that Laughlin and her husband have actually been named as defendants in a private class action lawsuit brought on by Stanford University graduates who claim their education and their degrees have been devalued due to their school's association with the scandal.
So I bet you that was a law student that thought that up.
Probably. But that, you know, it's not a bad idea. And another thing I read is that basically Singer, he set these up as charitable foundations, essentially. So they were charities. So when you paid this money, you paid it to a charity.
Uh-huh.
And what these people did, they would take this and use that as a tax deduction because they were basically paying a charity.
Right.
And so there's actually separate
tax evasion
type charges.
That's what I was wondering, why that hasn't been mentioned in any of this.
Well, I mean, and it might be something later that comes out.
Yeah.
Now, here's the interesting thing, is it depends on how their plea deal was structured. If the plea deal basically says that you will face no further prosecution for any of your actions involved in this, it might not be a bad deal.
Mm-hmm.
But if the plea deal is only with regards to
what we know of and not what we don't know.
Yeah, well, it's very narrow.
Yeah.
Then, you know, they might be in trouble for the IRS as well. Now, regardless of that, I think the IRS will come after them for maybe not criminally, but civilly for what they've done.
Sure.
They'll try to get that money back from the improper deductions they took for the charitable contributions.
Exactly.
So that's another avenue that's going to be a problem for these people later on too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I wondered all along. When they came back with the money laundering, I thought they were going to come back with the tax evasion, because if you're contributing, if you're writing off something that you gave to a charity and you know it's not a valid charity, they frown on that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's lying to the government. You're never supposed to lie to the government or your wife.
That's true. USC, actually, and a bunch of the different schools are taking steps, but USC was the one I read about, and their plan is to use any money that was received in connection with the scheme to fund scholarships for underprivileged students. So that's what the president basically said, which I like that. That's kind of a good step in the right direction. The university is also going through all their enrolled students and trying to make decisions about whether or not anybody else got there by bribery or whatnot as well. And any students that have been connected with the cheating scam are being denied admission into the school. And that basically six students who are in the current admission cycle are denied admission to USC already. They basically said, no, we're not even going to bother with you.
Huh.
Any student who was associated with this scandal is also not being allowed to register for classes or acquire transcripts while they're trying to figure all this out, too. They wouldn't say how many students that encompassed because basically they're not allowed to.
Uh-huh.
They just said that their status is under review. And the reason they're not allowed to, do you know why they're not allowed to?
HIPAA.
You're very close. It's very closely related to HIPAA. It's called FERPA.
FERPA.
The Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act of 1974.
Oh.
And basically, USC is not allowed to release information without prior written consent of the student, because that's private information. So it's very similar to HIPAA, but it's called FERPA.
Yeah, I knew they had things like that, because it's just like it's just like how college sports teams don't release information concerning injuries to players, and it's because they say they're not allowed to because of, you know, those kind of privacy laws.
Yeah, so we may never know how many people this actually encompasses.
Yeah.
Because, this could have been going on for who knows how long.
Hmm.
So.
But, you know, when I first heard it and they said so far they hadn't found any school administrators that were involved in it, and I'm like, what? They had to know what was going on. But then the more you read about it, no, they didn't have to. That could have been worked out just with a coach, between this guy and a coach. And a coach offers somebody a scholarship. The school doesn't go through and scrutinize all that, although they are now.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Now they're starting different procedures and scrutinizing who their scholarships are offered to. But at the time, if the coach offered somebody a scholarship and had all the proper paperwork, nobody went and did background checks or anything like that to see if they were lying. I mean, who would have even thought of something like that before now?
Well, no, because, you know, a coach, you think a coach would want to have the best players on their team and offer scholarships to people that can put them in a position to win.
But when you get the coach and you say, let's see, one less player that might sit the bench anyway, or $100,000. $100,000 would work.
Yeah. Now, it seemed like most of the sports that were involved, they weren't your, you know.
Yeah, they weren't the basketball team and the football team, stuff like that.
They weren't. There were places where you could actually hide them a little bit.
Soccer, crew.
Yeah.
What else? Hockey, something like that. I don't even think it was hockey.
No, I think it was hockey, but
track and field.
Yeah, where there was more people on it, and you could kind of hide them a little bit.
Yeah.
And there was one instance where they were actually photoshopping, and you had mentioned this earlier, photoshopping these kids' faces on pictures of
volleyball. That's another.
Yeah, volleyball of other athletes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, how atrocious is that?
That's kind of creepy too.
It is.
Yeah.
So you're photoshopping this kid's face onto
person's body
to try to show that they're a good athlete.
Yeah.
Ugh.
You're putting together a portfolio of their accomplishments or whatever, and you put that they were, you know, this good a player and things, and nobody's going to go back and check that because they figure the coach is working for the good of the team.
Yeah.
So the coach isn't going to bring some scrub on there that doesn't play.
They might for $100,000, I guess.
Yeah. Money talks and BS walks.
It does. So when you encompass the thing that Singer did, I mean, he was putting together a complete full service school agency here.
Exactly. If you just needed the test, he'd get you the test.
Yeah.
You know, or boost the scores. In some cases, they had the one, I guess it was Felicity Huffman's daughter. She had taken her SATs. Then under his tutelage, she came back, took it again, and scored 400 points higher. That's a good turnaround within a month or two, isn't
it? She must have studied hard.
Yeah, really. So that was the way that went. But, you know, when you think about money schemes and things like that, what's the first name that comes to mind when you think about that?
Bernie Madoff.
And he did what?
Was that a Ponzi scheme?
A Ponzi scheme. So, me being the natural curious one I am, I thought, I wonder why they call it a Ponzi scheme. Was that the way the scheme was set up, or was that a guy, or what was that? Well,
he was the guy that hung out at the diner, and whenever the jukebox skipped, he always hit the machine and went, hey!
That was Fonzie.
Oh.
He's on one of my new favorite shows, Barry.
Yeah.
Have you watched him on that?
That's a good show.
That is a great show. But Ponzi was a guy, and this happened actually 100 years ago in 1919. Charles Ponzi wasn't the first con man. Scams have originated since con men, but he was certainly, and he may not have been the worst, but the $10 million that Ponzi stole from investors a century ago is small change compared to current modern-day schemes such as Bernie Madoff, who he made $65 billion. So, but nevertheless, the flamboyant Ponzi has long been the poster child of scammers, and the Ponzi investigation represents one of the Postal Inspection Service's most famous cases. So that's, you know, where the mail fraud came in. The postal inspector actually investigated this case. So maybe that's where mail fraud came from. Said, who was Charles Ponzi and why has his name become synonymous with a swindle? And just what is a Ponzi scheme? Ponzi schemes are scams in which investors are promised exaggerated profits, often short-term, from supposedly can't-miss investments. If and when early investors are paid returns, the money doesn't come from actual investment gains. It comes from new cash pouring in from later investors. Since the con men pocket most of the money, the whole scam is ultimately doomed to collapse, but not before a lot of people lose a lot of money and the guy at the top gets a lot of money.
Yeah.
So Ponzi scammers promise windfall returns, counting on the victims to be either gullible or greedy, and sometimes both. The appeal of quick and hefty profits is precisely why some people fall for Ponzi schemes, even though they know clearly it's too good to be true. Now, Charles Ponzi was an Italian immigrant living in Boston in the early 20th century. He was a master at playing the gullibility greed game, and he was clever, but more than that, he was charming and charismatic, easily convincing people to jump aboard his pie-in-the-sky schemes. In his most famous fraud, he claimed to be taking advantage of foreign currency rates to make millions of dollars by manipulating postal reply coupons. These coupons could be purchased abroad in foreign currency and included in correspondence. Recipients of those letters could then redeem the coupons at U.S. post offices for enough postage to reply to the original correspondent. So, with great fanfare, he was also a genius at manipulating attention from the press. Ponzi opened his postal reply coupon-based business front, called the Security Exchange Company, near Boston City Hall in December 1919. He promised investors a 50% return within 90 days on $10, on $10 to $50,000 promissory notes based on postal reply coupon exchanges. It seemed as if everybody wanted in, and people stood in long and boisterous lines in the street outside his office, eager to surrender their hard-earned cash. Although the average investment was only $35, many people handed over their life savings. In all, more than 30,000 investors were duped.
Dear Lord.
By the dapper Mr. Ponzi.
That's huge numbers for back then.
Yeah. It said in the 9 months before he was arrested in August 1920, Ponzi raked in $10 million, much of which he expended on an extravagant lifestyle, living in a mansion, flashing $10,000 bills, sporting a gold-handled walking stick, waving to admirers from the back seat of a chauffeured car. He became the toast of the country and his name in the newspaper headlines all over the United States. But when the bubble burst, he was arrested and charged with mail fraud. Convicted, Ponzi was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison, but when he was released, he had to stand trial again in Massachusetts on state larceny charges. Out on bail while he was appealing his Massachusetts conviction, he headed to Florida and launched another scam. This is where another line came from. What can you think of that would be a scam concerning Florida?
Selling swampland?
You got it. That's where it came from. This time he was selling swampland as prime real estate. So that's where that saying came from. I got some swampland in Florida, I'll sell you. he got a lot of these sayings came from him.
He's a wheeler and a dealer.
Yeah. So Ponzi was arrested again and convicted for that as well. But before he could be returned to jail, he tried to flee the United States by disguising himself as a crewman on a merchant ship. He was caught in New Orleans. He was sent back to Massachusetts and served 7 more years in prison. Then he was deported to Italy, where he went to work for Benito Mussolini's government.
Mussolini was like, oh, this guy shows some promise.
Yeah.
He's a go-getter.
But he scammed the Italian treasury and was then forced to flee to South America. So he continued it there. Benito Mussolini, you don't scam Benito Mussolini because he don't mess around.
No, I think that'd be a bad idea.
So he ultimately died penniless in a Brazilian charity hospital. Charles Ponzi did make one dubious but enduring bequest. He left his name to dangerous scams that decades later continue to proliferate, hurting and sometimes bankrupting unwary victims.
Well, I don't think he did that out of the goodness of his heart.
No, he did it out of his evil ways. But I couldn't believe that he was I knew Ponzi scheme, what that was involved, but then I get down to Florida swampland, I couldn't believe that. He was involved in that too.
He was all over the place.
Yeah. If there's a scam, he could find it.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze.
So the Legal Breeze is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions about different legal topics we talked about. And today...
And today, illegal ones.
Yeah, today, illegal ones. The first question I have, what is honest service mail fraud?
Honest service mail fraud is when you commit some kind of crime concerning money and defrauding people.
That's true, but what...
With a public official.
What are you taking from the taking from someone?
Good and honest services.
That's right. The intangible right of honest services.
Yeah.
So that's where the honest service mail fraud comes from. And can it be public?
Yes, it has to be public. It can also be private, but it started out as being public.
That's right.
And then it was interpreted as private because you have a fiduciary duty.
That's right. You have a fiduciary duty and you have the right to the honest services from somebody who you expect the fiduciary duty from.
That's right. Like a banker.
And what
is it? Like Wells Fargo didn't do.
What is a fiduciary duty?
Fiduciary duty? That sounds like money crap, doesn't it?
It does.
I have a fiduciary duty. That's what if a child ingests dollar bills, that's what's going to come out the other end. Fiduciary duty.
just a child.
Well, I would think grown-ups would know better than to eat money. But that means that you are obligated to perform financial functions for someone. They're paying you to do this, and you have an obligation to do what you're being paid to do.
It's kind of the ballpark of it. The actual definition is that a fiduciary is a person who holds a legal or ethical relationship of trust with one or more parties. So, in essence, like a banker would have a fiduciary duty to somebody.
Stockbroker?
A stockbroker or a lawyer. I have fiduciary duties to my clients.
Sure.
So, it's basically when you have some sort of legal or ethical obligation to in a position of trust. Now, there is one privacy act we talked about, and it's one very similar to the one you like to quote a lot.
FERPA.
That's right. And what does FERPA stand for?
Oh, man. I'll never get that. Federal. No, let's see. Family. Enjoyment. Revolutionary.
Family.
Plop Act.
I'm going to put you out of your misery. It's the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. And basically, what FERPA stands for is that educational information cannot be released without prior written consent from the student. So it's like kind of like the educational equivalent of HIPAA.
Hmm.
And it's called FERPA.
FERPA. We always got to have a good acronym for everything when it has to do with the government.
Oh, I love a good acronym.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in law school, it seemed like the one class in particular, I forget what class it was, it wasn't law school. It was when I was in college and I was in a political science class. And I swear the whole class was basically just learning acronyms. That's all it was.
So you know what was going on in a room full of lawyers, huh?
No. So you know what's going on with a room full of
government people.
No, pretentious college students who want to argue and act like they're lawyers and talk about politics.
So if you're walking...
Ask me how I really feel about political science.
So if you're walking on a college campus and somebody says, hey, how'd you do on that test? FERPA.
It was a total Ponzi. Hey... Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.